Chapter 24. Cut off San Stephen, these dry details are of importance in one particular. They give me an opportunity of introducing one of the Mississippi's oddest peculiarities, that of shortening its length from time to time. If you will throw a long, pliant apple paring over your shoulder, it will pretty fairly shape itself into an average section of the Mississippi River. That is, the 9 or 10 hundred miles stretching from Cairo, Illinois, southward to New Orleans, the same being wonderfully crooked, with a brief straight bit here and there at wide intervals. The 200 mile stretch from Cairo northward to St. Louis is by no means so crooked, that being a rocky country which the river cannot cut much. The water cuts the alluvial banks of the lower river in two deep horseshoe curves. So deep, indeed, that in some places, if you were to get ashore at one extremity of the horseshoe and walk across the neck, half or three quarters of a mile, you could sit down and rest a couple of hours, while your steamer was coming around the long elbow, at a speed of 10 miles an hour, to take you aboard again. When the river is rising fast, some scoundrel whose plantation is back in the country, and therefore of inferior value, has only to watch his chance, cut a little gutter across the narrow neck of land some dark night, and turn the water into it, and in a wonderfully short time a miracle has happened. To wit, the whole Mississippi has taken possession of that little ditch, and placed the countryman's plantation on its bank, quadrupling its value, and that other party's formerly valuable plantation finds itself away out yonder on a big island. The old watercourse around it will soon shoal up, boats cannot approach within 10 miles of it, and down goes its value to a fourth of its former worth. Watches are kept on those narrow necks, at needful times, and if a man happens to be caught cutting a ditch across them, the chances are all against his ever having another opportunity to cut a ditch. Pray observe some of the effects of this ditching business. Once there was a neck opposite Port Hudson, Louisiana, which was only half a mile across, in its narrowest place. You could walk across there in 15 minutes. But if you made the journey around the Cape on a raft, you traveled 35 miles to accomplish the same thing. In 1722 the river darted through that neck, deserted its old bed, and thus shortened itself 35 miles. In the same way it shortened itself 25 miles at Black Hawk Point in 1699. Below Red River Landing, Rackerkai Cutoff was made, 40 or 50 years ago, I think. This shortened the river 28 miles. In our day, if you travel by river from the southernmost of these three cutoffs to the northernmost, you go only 70 miles. To do the same thing 176 years ago, one had to go 158 miles. Shortening of 88 miles in that trifling distance. At some forgotten time in the past, cutoffs were made above Vidalia, Louisiana, at Island 92, at Island 84, and at Tails Point. These shortened the river, in the aggregate, 77 miles. Since my own day on the Mississippi, cutoffs have been made at Hurricane Island, at Island 100, at Napoleon, Arkansas, at Walnut Bend, and at Council Bend. These shortened the river, in the aggregate, 67 miles. In my own time a cutoff was made at American Bend, which shortened the river 10 miles or more. Therefore, the Mississippi between Cairo and New Orleans was 1,215 miles long 176 years ago. It was 1,180 after the cutoff of 1722. It was 1,040 after the American Bend cutoff. It has lost 67 miles since. Consequently, its length is only 973 miles at present. Now, if I wanted to be one of those ponderous scientific people, and led on to prove what had occurred in the remote past by what had occurred in a given time in the recent past, or what will occur in the far future by what has occurred in late years, what an opportunity is here! Geology never had such a chance, nor such exact data to argue from. Nor development of species, apostrophe either. Glacial epochs are great things, but they are vague. Please observe. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That is an average of a trifle over 1 mile and a third per year. Therefore, any calm person, who is not blind or idiotic, can see that in the old Lytic-Silurian period, apostrophe just a million years ago next November, the lower Mississippi River was upwards of 1,300,000 miles long, and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And by the same token, any person can see that 742 years from now the lower Mississippi will be only a mile and three quarters long, and Cairo and New Orleans will have joined their streets together, and be plodding comfortably along under a single mayor, and a mutual board of aldermen. There is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. When the water begins to flow through one of those ditches I have been speaking of, it is time for the people thereabouts to move. The water cleaves the banks away like a knife. By the time the ditch has become 12 or 15 feet wide, the calamity is as good as accomplished, for no power on earth can stop it now. When the width has reached 100 yards, the banks begin to peel off in slices half an acre wide. The current flowing around the bend traveled formerly only 5 miles an hour. Now it is tremendously increased by the shortening of the distance. I was on board the first boat that tried to go through the cutoff at American Bend, but we did not get through. It was toward midnight, and a wild night it was, thunder, lightning, and torrents of rain. It was estimated that the current in the cutoff was making about 15 or 20 miles an hour. 12 or 13 was the best our boat could do, even in tolerably slack water, therefore perhaps we were foolish to try the cutoff. However, Mr. Brown was ambitious, and he kept on trying. The eddy running up the bank, under the point, apostrophe was about as swift as the current out in the middle, so we would go flying up the shore like a lightning express train, get on a big head of steam, and stand by for a surge, when we struck the current that was whirling by the point. But all our preparations were useless. The instant the current hit us, it spun us around like a top, the water deluged the forecastle, and the boat careened so far over that one could hardly keep his feet. The next instant we were away down the river, clawing with might and main to keep out of the woods. We tried the experiment four times. I stood on the forecastle companionway to see. It was astonishing to observe how suddenly the boat would spin around, and turn tail the moment she emerged from the eddy, and the current struck her nose. The sounding concussion and the quivering would have been about the same, if she had come full speed against a sandbank. Under the lightning flashes one could see the plantation cabins, and the goodly acres tumble into the river. And the crash they made was not a bad effort at thunder. Once, when we spun around, we only missed a house about 20 feet that had a light burning in the window, and in the same instant, that house went overboard. Nobody could stay on our forecastle. The water swept across it in a torrent every time we plunged athwart the current. At the end of our fourth effort, we brought up in the woods 2 miles below the cutoff. All the country there was overflowed, of course. A day or two later the cutoff was 3/4 of a mile wide, and boats passed up through it without much difficulty, and so saved 10 miles. The old Racker Guy cutoff reduced the river's length 28 miles. There used to be a tradition connected with it. It was said that a boat came along there in the night, and went around the enormous elbow the usual way, the pilots not knowing that the cutoff had been made. It was a grisly, hideous night, and all shapes were vague and distorted. The old bend had already begun to fill up, and the boat got to running away from mysterious reefs, and occasionally hitting one. The perplexed pilots fell to swearing, and finally uttered the entirely unnecessary wish that they might never get out of that place. As always happens in such cases, that particular prayer was answered, and the others neglected. So to this day, that phantom steamer is still butting around in that deserted river, trying to find her way out. More than one grave watchman has sworn to me that on drizzly, dismal nights, he has glanced fearfully down that forgotten river as he passed the head of the island, and seen the faint glow of the specter steamer's lights drifting through the distant gloom, and heard the muffled cough of her escape pipes, and the plaintive cry of her leadsmen. In the absence of further statistics, I beg to close this chapter with one more reminiscence of Stephen. Most of the captains and pilots held Stephen's note for borrowed sums, ranging from $250 upward. Stephen never paid one of these notes, but he was very prompt and very zealous about renewing them every 12 months. Of course, there came a time, at last, when Stephen could no longer borrow of his ancient creditors, so he was obliged to lie in wait for new men who did not know him. Such a victim was good-hearted, simple-natured young Yates.
I use a fictitious name, but the real name began, as this one does, with a Y.
Young Yates graduated as a pilot, got a berth, and when the month was ended, and he stepped up to the clerk's office, and received his $250 in crisp new bills, Stephen was there. His silvery tongue began to wag, and in a very little, while Yates' $250 had changed hands. The fact was soon known at pilot headquarters, and the amusement and satisfaction of the old creditors were large and generous. But innocent Yates never suspected that Stephen's promise to pay promptly at the end of the week was a worthless one. Yates called for his money at the stipulated time. Stephen sweetened him up, and put him off a week. He called then, according to agreement, and came away sugar-coated again, but suffering under another postponement. So the thing went on. Yates haunted Stephen week after week, to no purpose, and at last gave it up. And then straightway Stephen began to haunt Yates. Wherever Yates appeared, there was the inevitable Stephen. And not only there, but beaming with affection and gushing with apologies for not being able to pay. By and by, whenever poor Yates saw him coming, he would turn and fly, and drag his company with him, if he had company, but it was of no use. His debtor would run him down and corner him. Panting and red-faced, Stephen would come, with outstretched hands and eager eyes, invade the conversation, shake both of Yates' arms loose in their sockets, and begin, "My, what a race I've had. I saw you didn't see me, and so I clapped on all steam for fear I'd miss you entirely. And here you are. There, just stand so, and let me look at you. Just the same old noble countenance."
The Yates friend.
"Just look at him. Look at him. Ain't it just good to look at him? Ain't it now? Ain't he just a picture? Some call him a picture. I call him a panorama. That's what he is, an entire panorama. And now I'm reminded. How I do wish I could have seen you an hour earlier. For 24 hours I've been saving up that $250 for you. Been looking for you everywhere. I waited at the planter's from 6 yesterday evening till 2 o'clock this morning, without rest or food. My wife says, 'Where have you been all night?' I said, 'This debt lies heavy on my mind.' She says, 'In all my days I never saw a man take a debt to heart the way you do.' I said, 'It's my nature, how can I change it?' She says, 'Well, do go to bed and get some rest.' I said, 'Not till that poor, noble young man has got his money.' So I sat up all night, and this morning out I shot, and the first man I struck told me you had shipped on the Grand Turk and gone to New Orleans. Well, sir, I had to lean up against a building and cry. So help me goodness, I couldn't help it. The man that owned the place come out cleaning up with a rag, and said he didn't like to have people cry against his building, and then it seemed to me that the whole world had turned against me, and it wasn't any use to live anymore. And coming along an hour ago, suffering no man knows what agony, I met Jim Wilson, and paid him the $250 on account. And to think that here you are now, and I haven't got a cent.
But as sure as I am standing here on this ground on this particular brick, there, I've scratched a mark on the brick to remember it by. I'll borrow that money and pay it over to you at 12 o'clock sharp tomorrow. Now, stand so. Let me look at you just once more. Apostrophe, apostrophe, and so on. Yates' life became a burden to him. He could not escape his debtor, and his debtor's awful sufferings on account of not being able to pay. He dreaded to show himself in the street, lest he should find Stephen lying in wait for him at the comer. Bogart's billiard saloon was a great resort for pilots in those days. They met there about as much to exchange river news as to play. One morning Yates was there, Stephen was there too, but kept out of sight. But by and by, when about all the pilots had arrived who were in town, Stephen suddenly appeared in the midst, and rushed for Yates as for a long-lost brother. Oh, I am so glad to see you. Oh my soul, the sight of you is such a comfort to my eyes. Gentlemen, I owe all of you money. Among you I owe probably $40,000. I want to pay it. I intend to pay it every last cent of it. You all know, without my telling you, what sorrow it has cost me to remain so long under such deep obligations to such patient and generous friends. But the sharpest pang I suffer, by far the sharpest, is from the debt I owe to this noble young man here. And I have come to this place this morning, especially to make the announcement, that I have at last found a method whereby I can pay off all my debts. And most especially I wanted him to be here when I announced it. Yes, my faithful friend, my benefactor, I found the method. I found the method to pay off all my debts, and you'll get your money. Apostrophe, apostrophe, hope dawned in Yates' eye. Then Stephen, beaming benignantly, and placing his hand upon Yates' head, added, I am going to pay them off in alphabetical order. Apostrophe, apostrophe, then he turned and disappeared. The full significance of Stephen's method did not dawn upon the perplexed and musing crowd for some 2 minutes, and then Yates murmured with a sigh, well, the wise stand a gaudy chance. He won't get any further than the seas in this world, and I reckon that after a good deal of eternity has wasted away in the next one, I'll still be referred to up there as that poor, ragged pilot that came here from St. Louis in the early days. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.